Special thanks to Peloton for sponsoring this episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. Coming up next on The Jordan Harbinger Show.
If there's one message that I can leave to people, is that your choices to respond and react to the situations that you're meeting today are solely within your control. Solely. Whether you are hyper successful and you decide what you want to do next, whether you are failing miserable and you're deeply unhappy, or you feel like you're just floating and you're just like kind of like, everyone seems like they all have it around me. It's all noise. The person that actually creates momentum and progress is the one that doesn't listen to that voice unless it's using it for fuel to actually make progression and positive movement. That is within you. That's the power of the mind.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most fascinating people. We have in-depth conversations with scientists, entrepreneurs, spies and psychologists, even the occasional Russian chess grandmaster, investigative journalist, drug trafficker, or gold smuggler. And each episode turns our guests' wisdom into practical advice that you can use to build a deeper understanding of how the world works and become a better thinker. If you're new to the show or you want to tell your friends about the show, I suggest our episode starter packs as a place to begin. These are collections of our favorite episodes organized by topic that'll help new listeners get a taste of everything we do here on the show. Topics like persuasion, influence, crime and cults, abnormal psychology, and more. Just visit jordanharbinger.com/start or search for us in your Spotify app to get started. By the way, if you haven't heard yet, we've launched a new AI tool built on OpenAI for the show. We're still ironing out a little bit of kinks here and there, but it is amazing. You can basically type in any question or query that you want. It'll cover all of our episodes. Soon we'll be adding show notes and articles as well. It'll give you everything we've ever recorded about a topic. So, for example, you could type in, how do I identify a financial scam? Or how do I draw a boundary with my parents? Or what's the BetterHelp promo code? And the bot will return every result for that question in a neat and friendly interface. The promo codes are also clickable, so it's a really great way to support the show there. It's just a really incredible tool if you want to go deeper into a certain subject or go back and find an episode you can't quite remember just based on what it was about. Maybe you want to compile a bunch of material to read or you want to share the show with other people. It's very close to your own personalized starter pack there. Just go to the website, jordanharbinger.com, click AI on the top and it'll take you right there. Definitely give it a go, check it out. Let me know any bugs. There are some weird results that pop out of there. One said that my mom was a racist. She's not a racist, but you know, we're just ironing out those kinks. Thanks for checking it out. Have fun. Man, the AI future really is here. All right, now today on the show, the most decorated American in Winter Games history, the winner, also the winner of Dancing with the Stars, Apollo Ohno. Really had fun with this one. Ended up hanging out all day and doing a cold plunge sauna session and just chatting a ton. I think it sort of shows up in the relaxed vibe here of this conversation as well. Today, Apollo and I discuss self-sabotage, mental preparedness, the inner game of sports and athletics, the inner game of anything for that matter. We also talk about depression, loss of focus, rebellion, and quitting, and some of the darker side of competing at an elite level. There's a ton of practical drills and strategies in the episode. I know you're going to dig the conversation. Even if you don't care about skating, sports, or any of that, y'all know I'm allergic to most of that stuff myself. All right, here we go with Apollo Ohno.
Oh, yeah!
I took the DNA fitness test. I know we're talking about DNA in the car. Mm-hmm. The doctor went over it, goes, you have a rare combination of DNA that Olympic speed skaters have mostly. Like a fast twitch muscle thing that affect, like Olympic sprinters and speed skaters all have this combination of DNA. It was either blood work or spit, and I can't remember. And then they sequence your genome and they go, hey, here's a lot of your fitness genes or like different kinds of DNA that you have that makes you like. Like one of the things they said, don't worry about doing a low carb diet because it's not really your genotype. It won't respond as well to that anyway, so you don't have to kill yourself. They were like, you have this potential, you know, you could have been an Olympic speed skater with these genes. And I'm like, I don't think that's the compliment you think it is. Like, here's how far you have fallen short of your potential, Jordan. If you tried harder or been athletic at all, you could have been in the Olympics, but you didn't. You just aren't. Now you're a podcaster. So yeah, I was thinking, oh, he's probably had his genes sequenced at some point. Have
not
you done
sequenced,
that?
But we've done like, we did a lot of interesting tests. So we did a test where we would measure from when your heart would beat to how fast it would relax. We'd measure that time. We would do eyesight tests to where how quickly can your eyes' ability to focus on an object. So, you know, we skate, you know, basically counterclockwise mm-hmm. only. And we have these blocks on both sides of the rink, right? So think of like a peanut-shaped pattern is how we skate, right? And on each side of the peanut that's vertical is these seven blocks, right? They basically look little, like almost like mini plungers, right, on the ice. And so your ability to measure as you're moving 30 to 35 miles an hour or whatever, how fast you're going, your eye's ability to measure each one of those blocks and see each one as you're going around it. Like my eye had a really unique ability of being able to focus and reconcentrate on an object that was far away three times faster than that of someone who was not a speed skater. This is like at the height of our career. And I don't know why we were taking these tests, but at the US Olympic Sports Science Training Center, we did all kinds of things. VO2 max, wind gate test to measure power output. We do power plate testing. You know, we would do all kinds of interesting stuff.
It reminds me of that show, Sports Science. Remember that show? Did you ever see that?
With John Brinkus.
I think And it would be like, this is the amount of force that you're getting punched in the face with if you get hit by Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
And they like test it. Yeah.
I don't want to be in that test subject.
No, that is not, that's unsafe for human testing. I know you were raised by a single dad who is immigrant, hairdresser, explains why your hair is always on fleek, on or off camera. I will say, I'm surprised he let you get away with the soul patch during the games.
I'm surprised that anyone allowed me to get away with any type of those haircuts back from 20 years ago. I looked completely ridiculous, man. It was ridiculous.
And the soul patch,
which lasted a very long time.
It did.
And partially, I just didn't know what else to do with it. I thought like, well, I should have some kind of facial hair, right? I'm like walking around. But anytime I ever grew out facial hair in my face, if I was like standing over here in the distance, you just think, oh, wow, that guy looks like he's like got some dirt like on his face. Mm-hmm. It didn't look nice. It looked like it was messed up.
It's one of those things where, well, he won a bunch of gold medals. Nobody can say anything to him. Nobody can say it. Nobody can tell him how to do anything. It's like you're surrounded by all these.
Jordan, I needed to have this talk. I needed the intervention.
He needed the intervention.
Like, hey, listen, man.
It's time to shave it.
The medals were amazing. Something that we got to tell you. This is very, 1995.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. They want their soul patch back. Yeah. Your dad wanted to keep you busy because he worked so much. That's what got you started in skating, swimming, and singing, right?
Yeah. So my dad's interesting because as a single parent, I think he had two kind of objectives. Number one, he didn't have time to watch over me at all times. Mm-hmm. So he had to place me into every single activity he possibly could that would keep me busy so I just wouldn't get in trouble. I wouldn't get mischievous. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't kind of run off or do whatever. And he also felt like I was highly athletic because I had so much energy. So he placed me in all these after-school activities from, like you said, choir to like acting to, swimming, inline skating, everything. And I excelled at almost all of them, with the exception of track and field and basketball. We're not the ones.
Yeah.
But, growing up, I thought I was going to go to some amazing university and become a swimmer. Hmm. That's my dad's aspirations for me. And it just never happened. I wanted to play different sports, but my dad didn't want me to get injured. And I just remember being in junior high school and how big the kids were back then. These were grown men. They had goatees. And I was like, you are not 13. It is impossible that you're 13.
True.
You're 6'3". This is crazy.
Yeah.
These kids are monsters.
Well, you and I are not big dudes even now. We have maxed out, I think.
Yeah.
But you started getting in with a bad crowd from what I understand.
Well, when I was growing up, so I think every kid goes through experiences where they have kind of choices, right? They seek individuality. We were talking about this kind of on the way over here.
Yeah.
Is one side is they just want to go against the parents' grain. So the parent says, you go this way, I want to go this way. And it doesn't really matter what the parent says. That was kind of like with my dad, where he wanted me to go in this direction of being highly productive, highly effective, being optimizing all my time throughout my day and always growing and pursuing to be my absolute best. All I wanted to do was just hang out with my friends. And if that crowd of friends was not in line with what his goals were, it made me more happy. The environment is a big part of, I think, as I look to have my future kids, I want to be and hopefully have them grow in an environment that is really conducive to them becoming a better version of themselves. Yes, they're going to face challenges and all those things. So when you say, Paul, you kind of ran in this kind of interesting crowd, the kids were just mischievous.
Yeah.
They were always pretty much up to no good in some capacity. And they weren't bad kids, right? I didn't live in a really bad area. I just think these kids had too much time on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is quite normal in the early teenage formative years where kids are just vying for their own path and individuality. So, yeah, man, it was, I think my dad knew that there was probably an issue is when someone had called him to say some of the kids at the school were trying to blow up the school toilet or something like that. I don't know why we would do that.
Yeah,
or why
we did that too. We did that. There's no reason why. The reason is because you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, that's where sport became a really big part of my life. And my dad saw that early, was like, wow, this kid has all this energy. Mm-hmm. He's so like rambunctious. How do I teach this kid the fundamentals of life, but also pursue something in a highly focused manner?
I think that's fortunate, because if you have the amount of drive that you obviously have, it's kind of dangerous in a young guy to have that, or woman for that matter. It's dangerous to have that when it's unfocused. I mean, you see that now, but back then it's like, well, who cares? You know, do whatever you want to do. But your dad was smart, I think, to see that and go, this cannon aimed in the wrong direction is going to be bad news.
I think having no roadmap or no direction or no goal is bad news. Because then you're floating across this plane and you're just ending up in this no man's land. You don't know where you are. That's even today, like even today. So I think like regardless of you or whatever it is that you're setting forth for yourself, this particular goal, this like habit, this routine, this thing that you're trying to achieve, by having a simple metric of being able to measure that or see it in some way, keeps you at least headed in that direction. The possible vicinity could be way off by the time you get there, but at least you're going in this direction versus floating around in this kind of sphere where you wake up in 6 years or 10 years, and you're like, shit, I am literally like no closer to my goal than I was 10 years ago. And in fact, I am actually further behind than I was in 10 years ago. That to me is a big fear, is like having an epiphany about like what I think I want my life to be, having a commitment to myself, a promise to myself, and then saying, I'm going to try this regardless of outcome, and I'm going to pursue this thing. And then 2 years in, forgetting why you're doing that thing, going off track, now you're doing something entirely different, and you've forgotten how far you've gone in a complete opposite direction. And you're now, you know, older, and you get to an age where you say, you know what, I don't have that same amount of enthusiasm, energy, time, resources, or even like focus that I did when I was maybe in my 20s or my 30s or my 40s. And now you're looking at yourself in your 50 or whatever, and you're saying like, man, like I could have done that, but I allowed myself to get distracted. And I say this from experience, right? So like having gone through the past 12 years of my life, the first, you know, like primary years of my formative career, so to speak, were deeply ingrained in trying to be this like superhuman athlete pursuing Olympic dreams, which was incredible. Great, like, learning lessons and power embedded in that. And then I retired, and it was like a snap of finger. I feel like I was starting over. I was like, oh my God, I don't even know who I am as a person.
I've heard you say that once when you got ahead of the best racer in one of your races, you actually self-sabotaged and you held back. What is happening there in your mind when you're doing something like that?
In your particular instance where you're asking me, when I think of self-sabotage, by the way, Jordan, I'm not thinking about if I'm in the lead already. I'm thinking self-sabotage in the realm of, so my skating style was I would always wait until the last like one lap or two laps remaining to go and attack this big move and then try to win the race. Now, the longer you wait to make that move, the higher the risk curve goes up of you making a mistake and that happening. If you try four laps to go and you try it once, you can try it again and again and again. You get three more times or maybe more, six times you can try to make that pass to win. If you try to make one move in the last lap, you have no room for error. And so it's like playing with fire. How close to the fire can I get and then pull back? How close can I get to the fire and pull back? And there's this addictive quality also outside of the fire component of saying, I'm so afraid of actually being my best. And this is in reference to what you were saying. So if I pass someone early and now I'm in the lead, in short track speed skating, if you go all out and you're, you know, you're full pedal to the metal, you're giving 100% of yourself, and then someone passes you on the outside, that's a very like defeating feeling that you have. You feel like someone, it's called going over the top. It's just so much emasculating in so many ways. And so I was afraid of feeling that emotional state of basically showing up and my best self was just simply not good enough. And so what I would do is I would self-sabotage to where I would effectively create a scenario that was so impossible to overcome by waiting so late in the race to pass that if I didn't make that move or if something happened and made a mistake, I could subconsciously try to empathize with myself and say, well, if you had just moved the lap earlier, everything would have been fine. So it was a total cop-out. It was a complete failure in my own ability to face this fear that I had of saying like, hey, like you were just afraid of actually just going out there and failing. That's what you were doing. And instead, you're setting these roadblocks in front of yourself that were completely unnecessary, because you didn't want to deal with this emotional state that you put there yourself. And so it's a trick that we play on ourselves, mm-hmm. I think, not only. So so speed skating to me is just life lessons, right? These things present themselves in the way that we approach relationships, the way that we approach our careers, the way that we approach it improving ourselves. And we typically self-sabotage for so many different reasons, right? So that we can empathize with ourselves, which, by the way, is important in some respects. But we empathize with ourselves to explain to ourselves why it's okay why we did those things. And I think it's fine as long as you are saying, but I no longer choose to be that. If you continue making that mistake over and over and over again, you're going nowhere. And you're always going to create this habit. So it's going to be so ingrained in your DNA or in your mm-hmm. hardwired system. It's going to be harder and harder to break that. So the more and more you try something and you start to practice that as the new normal, that's hard to break through.
How long did it take you to realize you were doing that? Or did somebody else point it out?
My coaches used to tell me all the time. They were like, you literally, Apollo, should be winning every single race that you step on the ice. You got to stop skating from the back. This is sabotage. You're basically sabotaging yourself. Hmm. What are you afraid of? And, you know, in my head, I was like, oh, you know, I'm not afraid of anything.
Right. Yeah. Nothing.
But my actions were totally different. And so it took me years, actually, to really understand the power of relinquishing these predispositions about myself. And I think a lot of this actually came from a lack of self-confidence. Right. So like when I trained, I had immense strength and confidence, but it was derived from a place that I was so insecure about never being prepared enough to show up and be really good. And so I leaned on that emotional trait of being so scared of not being enough that it drove me to these insane psychopathic levels of commitment and discipline on a like minute by minute level for years, like well over a decade, where every single workout mattered to me for years. Like, and then it just really didn't. Like, it didn't matter if I had pizza one day and the next day I ate clean, like in the height of my training. Like, it was just a furnace. Like, I could literally sure. eat whatever I wanted and I would be fine. You psychologically believe that the devil's in the details and you become millimeter focused. And so I try to control every single mechanism. And I realized, you know, much later in my life now that there's power in that if you use it to your advantage as a tool. If it consumes you.
Yeah, if you're a slave to it.
If you're a slave to it. And so I was handcuffed to a lot of times to my emotions. You know, we did this documentary, The Weight of Gold, where we talk a lot about this kind of psychological prison that many athletes and just people, sometimes they live within, sometimes not by their choice, right? Those who suffer from depression mm-hmm. and these suicidal thoughts. And then others who create this self-imprisonment in their own mind. And that's where I was, right? I was in the state where I wasn't fully growing because I was so just consumed by this, you're not good enough. You'll never be good enough. Everyone else is better than you. And you have to train harder, better, longer, stronger, faster than everyone, which is very powerful if you lean on that. But I didn't know it, you know?
It's got to be a tough way to motivate. I know that you, at one point, actually ran away and didn't even go to the Olympic training camp. And your dad found out because your coach called him, which must have been a really hard conversation to have with your dad after all that time. Like, it seems like you're just trying so hard to not be successful at that point in your life.
Well, I was 14.
Yeah. So I'm not saying I don't understand it. I'm just saying you must have thought about quitting all the time.
Well, so the first time I ever thought about quitting was I was about 12 and a half years old. My father had started to wake me up at about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh yeah, wow.
And he would take me to these empty school and church parking lots. And he would keep his Volkswagen Rabbit lights on, strapped a miner's light to my helmet, and I had rollerblades on. And he would just make me skate around in these empty parking lots. Like at 3:30.
How was that not?
It was horrible.
That's terrible.
Who wants to do that? I don't want to do that today.
And
like,
where did you grow? This is Seattle?
Yeah, south of Seattle.
So it's freaking freezing half the year.
It's freezing. And I realize now why he did it. So like the days that it wasn't raining, he would just wake me up and make me go do this. Because he didn't have time to take me after school.
Well, yeah, but oh my
right?
God.
Right? So God. Like, and he felt that I was like trying to, you know, I was like joining like the local roller skating team.
Sure.
So my dad, being an immigrant from Japan, his only fundamental truth to him is survival and then thrive, mm-hmm. right? And so you, Apollo, are at a disadvantage because everyone else has time to go train mm-hmm. with practice. You don't. So you have to go find it on your own. We didn't talk about sleep back then and like optimizing blue light blocking glasses my cooling bed and all this stuff. It was just like,
biohacking.
Just like, all right, get up, go. And so that was the first time I ever thought about quitting because after, I don't know how long this went on for, And I'm pretty sure he would get in trouble if he did that today.
Now it's called child abuse, but yeah. Back then it was just good old-fashioned motivation.
Good old-fashioned, yeah, just grit and gristle. And I remember telling him one time, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. I hate this or something like that. And he pulls over on the side of the road and he made it so hard for me to quit. Not because he said, you're not quitting, but he asked me very potent questions. Explain to me why you want to quit. What does it mean to quit? So this like provoking questions to make me rethink what my answers were going to be. Because as a child, you only seek the one love that I had was with my father. Mm-hmm. I wanted his approval more than anything. I could go win a race, but I would be looking for my dad in the stands. And if he was like happy, I was like, oh.
Thank God.
Like, okay, now I did it.
Sure.
Right? Interesting, right?
It's interesting, but not, it's totally human.
Yeah, so 12 years old till like end of career, like final Olympic Games, eighth medal. I'm still looking for my dad.
Wow.
40 years old, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, you know,
hey,
like,
that's fair.
Like, still looking for my dad.
Sure.
It's interesting how these things percolate over time. And so I realize that now and I like embrace it today. So that's when I first thought about quitting. And that was a traumatic experience, but one that was very powerful. It taught me, I think, this idea around discipline and doing things above and beyond what other people are willing to do in order to achieve something that others would view as extreme. And for someone like myself who wasn't genetically gifted in many aspects of the sport, like I was gifted in certain aspects of the sport, but certain areas required me to do things that my competitors or even teammates simply were not willing to go through and commit to on the level of consistency that I did. And this was blessed enough to be, I realized this quite early that in order for me to break out of the realm of performance that our team was typically looked at, I needed to go do things that were outside of the realm of normalcy. And that came in the form of these like extreme training environments that started when I was 12, that came from my dad.
This is all mental game stuff that you talk about in some of your books as well. And I think you said the most difficult opponent is always yourself, or maybe that's like Sun Tzu or something that you... It seems like something maybe you didn't come up with completely on your own.
I'm pretty sure I didn't come up with that one.
It makes sense that the mental game is the peak of competition, because I would imagine when everybody you compete against is in super prime physical condition, everybody's got good coaching, strength, diet, training, whatever it is that you all have. You all have access to these resources, at least at some point during your training. The mental game, it can not only be an edge, but it's got to be, it is the edge. It's got to be the only edge that you can get. If everybody's in super prime physical condition, some people have a genetic predisposition that's a little bit better or whatever. But other than that, it's just about who can, maybe tougher is not quite the right word, but who can get up at 3:30 in the morning in an ass-cold Seattle winter and roller skate around a parking lot, and who's just going to take the easy way out?
I think every sport's a bit different. I think some sports, like you take a Michael Phelps, for example, right? Someone who, you look at his body, he is literally designed to be a swimmer.
He's long, and then he's got a, what is his wingspan, super wide?
Like he could touch the glass and this thing at the same time, just sitting here. It's just like unbelievable. Like Dhalsim from Street Fighter, you know? This is unreal.
Stretchy guy, yeah.
Yeah, just unbelievable. So I think, when I was younger, to me, the power of belief is the real lesson. So I just believed, A, that I wasn't as good as everybody else.
Yeah.
When I was. I clearly was. Two, what was really powerful was this idea that I could tap into this unknown reservoir of performance potential that had so many layers deep. And so I believed in this, placebo or not, didn't matter. I believed that there was this sixth gear that I had access to, then everyone else only had five. And it was part like me being an American and being like, well, I'm just American.
Watching so
like,
Rocky.
I just have this sixth gear. I just want it better and more than they do. As silly as that may sound, I truly believe that. And so I would skate lap times and do these moves on the ice in these finals that I'd never practiced before. So there's truth behind that. But I do think like there's in some instances like Apollo, no matter how much you think it, you're not going to go play in the NFL. It's just not going
to
happen.
Yeah,
dude.
Okay.
Like, it's just so not going to happen,
to it.
Right?
So yeah,
there's obviously limits to that.
Sure.
Stuff. But I do think if you can match your strengths with this like incredible mindset that is consistently tapped into, and you compound that over long durations of time, you create something extraordinary. And I don't care who it is and what you're doing, that's what it takes. We were talking about like podcasting before or like pursuing career stuff. Everyone now today, not just, and it's not our fault. Like, this is just the growth of how our society is evolving. I saw this meme the other day. It was really interesting. It's cartoon chicken, And it had a picture and it says, I just want to skip to the part where I'm really good at everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's like the perfect like experience for what we're going through.
Yeah, it is.
But the reason why people get great at doing something is because they have gone through the early stages of the pain, of the resistance, of breaking through that resistance, and the consistency of that effort. And over time is when you kind of rip open the curtain. Mm-hmm. You're like, now I'm in flow. Now I'm in this state where things seamlessly have come together. But, you know, like friends that you see like sell their companies 10 years later for like, you know, $1 billion.
Yeah.
It's not an overnight success. Like 10 years ago, they were scrapping together, like just trying to figure it out. To me, that's like always a great reminder that if I look at what I'm trying to do next, whatever career, whatever entrepreneurial idea I have, whatever new trajectory that I'm pursuing, I look at this and say, okay, if this is the Olympics, Apollo, and this is a brand new endeavor, are you going to become an Olympic champion in 1 year of training? No, this is going to take a long time. So be willing to commit yourself to something regardless of outcome in the beginning and stick through it and you will learn. And the years will go by like this. But I think to me, it's all about that consistency of habit.
Tell me about your dad's speech after you didn't make the Olympic team, because I feel like this was such a good anecdote. And I feel like this is one of those moments that you'll remember for the rest of your life. And I wonder if you replay it in your head when you backslide into your old bullshit.
The first Olympic trials that I had went to, this was the 1998 Olympic trials. I'll give you background and context associated. The story goes like this. So 1996 and 1997, I was ranked number one in the US, not just for my age group. So I was 14 years old.
Jeez.
I had just won the world team trials. I went to go compete with our older team, who was like 30 plus years old, these guys. And I was 14 years old. I still had braces, dude. I went from that experience to coming back home to Seattle. And then less than a year later was the 1998 Nagano Olympic trials. Mm. Now, the whole year, I just basically just throw it away for training. Like went against the grain, went through the motions, didn't really commit myself, was going back into this resistant attitude towards authority and also just like my coaches and my teammates. I didn't want to be there. And so I showed up to the Olympic trials and I went from first place the less than a year before, beating all these guys, to getting dead last at those trials.
Oof.
So I failed. Here's what the hard part was for my dad. I didn't know this until much later. He had already bought tickets to go to the Olympic Games. He was going back home for one of the first times ever since he had left Japan to come to the United States. It was for him, it was this affirmation of like, see, to his mom and dad.
It's a victory tour.
It's like, hey, like, yeah, you told me not to go to America, and I'm coming back and look what I helped produce.
Mm-hmm.
My son, carrying our family name, is going to make you proud by competing for the US back on home soil. See, it took us three generations to create him, and now he's here, and I wasn't going anymore. And so he took me from that Olympic trials, saw this habit that was forming, this incredible talent that I had, incredible potential and opportunity, and I literally just threw it away. And so he took me and he drove me to this place about 3.5 hours southwest of Seattle in this area called Moclips or Copalis Beach area. And it sounds very nice every time I say beach, and it's very beautiful. But in the dead of winter, it is just pouring rain.
Yeah.
It gets dark at like 3 p.m. And he drops me off at this old cabin that we used to stay at. And I remember staying at this old cabin and he tells me, he's like, you have to figure out what you're going to do with your life because you are not going to continuously throw opportunities like this away and not commit yourself. I'm not mad that you didn't make the team. I'm upset that you carried yourself the way that you did and you just basically went through the motions. You lacked the discipline and the effort, and that's unacceptable. And so he's like, when you're ready, call me.
I mean, at that point, you just wish he would yell at you.
I was like 15. I was like, what do you mean you drop me off? And so I was there alone and I had like some clothes. I had like some food. But I mean, no one goes to this place at this time of the year, by the way. It's like freezing cold. It rains all the time. And I didn't see someone for like 3 days, you know, and I just started like mindlessly training. And so while I was at this moment, was the first epiphany I had in my life was at the age of 15. I just kept asking myself, like, why are you here? Why is your dad doing this to you? Does he hate you? Like, this resentment I had towards him. I had no one to call. There's no video games. There's no Instagram. There's nothing. It's just me and nature, which today, now, like, I crave those
moments. Sure, sounds great. Yeah.
Sounds amazing. Right?
Not when you're 15,
solitude,
14.
Silence, quiet, just pure, just beautiful. But back then, I was really struggling. And I effectively came to the decision to say, like, all right, I'm going to give this speed skating thing another shot. This like obscure sport that like most people had never heard about. Mm-hmm. They kind of know what it is, but like never really watch. And I remember calling my dad. I'd been at the, I think, at the cabin by then, by like 7 days at that point. And I said, I've made a decision. He comes and drives and picks me up. Doesn't ask me what it was. I tell him on the way home. And then that's how my career really started to kickstart.
Wow.
And begin again. And so I moved back to Lake Placid, New York, upstate New York, to start training to make the world team. I got the last position to be selected to be an alternate on that team. And I had made a promise to myself. Again, this is the power of like these real promises. And I had promised myself, I said, when you leave this environment, this world championships, you are going to go back home and you're not going to hang out with your friends that you used to hang out with in the past. You are going to set forth a plan for yourself and you are going to attack that plan as hard as you possibly can. So I trained twice a day throughout the whole summer in, you know, south of Seattle.
Wow.
At the age of 15. And I showed up at the next training camp in like phenomenal shape. I mean, back then, I didn't know anything about sports science or all these things. I literally just started skyrocketing my performance. So, but that was a big learning lesson for me. A, my dad showed me some really tough love. B, the power, I think what's reminded me, at least the way it works for me, is to be near nature as much as possible, to come to really hard decisions and away from distraction. And then C, your results or not getting what you want is typically because you had previous expectations that were not met. So just clearly defining that is simple. If you had these expectations and you didn't accomplish them, what is the reasoning why? Did you try hard enough? Were you prepared enough? Is it out of your control? Like, what are some of these variables that you can keep under, you know, under your control? And some you just simply can't. And for me, a lot of those things were a lot of in my control and I just let them go away.
Yeah, right.
Right. So that was the big change there.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Apollo Ono. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by Peloton. A lot of people ask me how I'm able to stick to my fitness routine, especially since I have such a bananas schedule. For me, it's really creating a routine that is sustainable and can be duplicated on an ongoing basis. Consistency is the key, right? And Peloton helps me have a sustainable fitness routine because there are thousands of classes to choose from. It's also 24/7. I've always got time for it. I might only have 15 minutes in between calls, but I can still fit in a Peloton class. Peloton's really famous for their bikes, but they also make a top-notch rowing machine that stores upright, which you think no big deal, but when you try to have a rower on the floor, you'll be so glad this thing goes upright. If you're a newbie to rowing, the Peloton Row has sensors that can track your movements that shows you how your form is doing, and it warns you if you're doing something wrong that could injure you or whatever. And right now is the perfect time to get rowing with Peloton Row. We can promise you've never rowed like this before. Peloton Row offers a variety of classes for all levels and game-changing features that help you get rowing or advance what you can already do. Explore Peloton Row and financing options at onepeloton.com/row. This episode is also sponsored by Shopify. Hear that? That's every entrepreneur's favorite sound, another sale on Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're selling tea or t-shirts, costumes or ceramics, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can focus on successfully growing your business. Shopify covers every sales channel, from an in-person POS system to an all-in-one e-commerce platform. It even lets you sell across social media marketplaces like TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. Packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth, Shopify gives you complete control over your business and your brand without having to learn any new skills in design or code. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive business course library, Shopify is there to support your success every step of the way. What's incredible to me about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to revolutionize your business and take things to the next level. Now it's your turn to get serious about selling and try Shopify today. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Jordan, in all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Jordan to take your business to the next level today. Shopify.com/Jordan.
If you're wondering how I manage to book all these great authors, thinkers, and creators every single week, it's because of my network, and I'm teaching you how to build your network for free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. I know that networking is a cringy, gross word these days. I wanted to build a course that would help inspire other people to develop a relationship with you. Not a course that does it in a way where it seems salesy, but in a super easy, non-cringe, down-to-earth way. Nothing awkward, at least nothing too awkward. And it's built for introverts as well. So it's all online. Don't freak out. I'm not going to ask you to go give talks on stages or go to mixers. It just takes a few minutes a day. And many of the guests on the show already subscribe and contribute to the course. So come join us. You'll be in smart company where you belong. You can find the course at jordanharbinger.com/course. And now, back to Apollo Ono.
Oh, yeah!
He had an epic World Cup win. Most people think that's only for soccer. Apparently, there's a speed skating World Cup,
yeah,
too.
Much different, I'll tell you yeah. that. Much different.
But you studied your opponents to exhaustion. There's some anecdote of you, I don't know, on a treadmill or a bike. I can't remember what it was, but it was like you were watching tape, knowing these guys' skating abilities better than maybe even they know their skating abilities, which is really, that says a lot, because you're doing this at in an age where most people are not thinking about anything important. The level of focus is just, it's pretty incredible. Maybe you have to be locked in a freezing cabin in southern Washington, southwestern Washington, in order to get there.
That's the other side of ADHD, is this unique ability is when you get locked in, these blinders go on. That time dilation is very real. Time slows down. You can't see anything else around you. You are in this complete zone state, this flow state, where it's you and whatever it is that you're pursuing or doing. And that's what I did. Every day for 2 hours, an hour and a half to 2 hours, I would watch skating tapes. And I took these old skating tapes that we had from the team. I brought them home and I watched the same six athletes who I admired the most. Each athlete had a very specific technical thing they did naturally extremely well and a style of skating that was radically different from each other. And I became so wholeheartedly obsessed with the way that they skated. And I learned how to piece together the greatest aspects of their attributes to create my own style. And then I became so ingrained in watching the human behavior of their quirks of when they got on the ice, when they finished the race, how they celebrated, how they reacted when they lost on the ice. I started watching that. And that's how I become really obsessed with actually learning to read my opponents in real time. So I could tell by watching other athletes in the trainings leading up to a race, because if we arrive on a Sunday night, we have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday to acclimate, get used to the ice, the time zone difference, wherever we're competing or training. And then Friday, Saturday, Sunday is the competition. So we have almost a full week of basically getting ready. And during that time, I'm not watching in awe. I'm watching to see if there's any pattern recognition that I can remember, or if I'm seeing it, basically they're faking it. So there were certain athletes I always knew if they were having an amazing training session or an amazing day, or they were faking it. Everyone wears the poker mask, the poker face, right? When you go out there.
But you had a baseline for everybody from the tapes.
I had a baseline. And so I just watched these things and it was beautiful. And so I try to take that level of obsession and hopefully modify that now in a way that's a little bit more, less toxic per se.
I was going to say less of a psychopath trait more of a,
And more in a way to say like, well, if this is what you want to do now, this is the amount of work that it's going to require this consistently for this long. Before, you're younger, you don't know anything. You find something that you find deeply intoxicating, which happened for me to be analysis and pursuing the sport and trying to be my best self, using my mind. Then I ran down the rabbit hole of like sports psychology and meditation and visualization and breath work and all these things that I luckily was introduced by a lot of these other people who studied sports psychology and clinical psychology as a profession. And they jumped on board our team as assistant coaches to be the sports psych for our team to help teach about the power of the mind and training the mind in lieu of achieving outsized results than if you did not use that type of training.
I've heard that you would skate while hungry. Is that true?
Yeah.
Why? Is that like a hanger thing? Trying to harness the hunger? Or is it like I'm 30 ounces lighter because I haven't eaten breakfast?
I mean, I wasn't like starving, but I definitely was hungry.
Huh.
Like my stomach's growling now.
Yeah.
I'm probably hungry.
Sure.
But there's something about like, I think natural acute and sharpness associated with not having like a full stomach and all the blood rushing to your stomach to process. Huh. So I would eat quite light. I think it came from, so my old friend and sports psychologist, Doug Jowdy, who's still practicing today, right? He wrote a book, this amazing book called Gold Medal Mind. If you ever want to read his book, it just came out, The Gold Medal Mind. So he's the first one that used to tell me, because I was obsessed with this, like living in the Olympic Training Center, I was surrounded by the speed skating team, but I was surrounded by boxers, by the weightlifting team, by some track and field people, by swimmers, by track cyclists, by wrestlers. Now, end with wrestlers, because this is where I learned so much about the power of like that warrior mindset. And so a lot of the people on my team, and I say this with every due amount of respect, I just, you know, sometimes when you're in an environment, all you want is something that's different.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
So that's what I was seeking. And so my roommate for a period of time was this wrestler.
They didn't put you in the room with a...
They did, but we had an odd number of team members. So I was one of the...
It's like being an exchange student.
Yeah. So the wrestlers, for some reason, in the Olympic Training Center were always looked at as being a bit crazy, just wired differently. And I think you have to be... If you've ever seen a wrestler go through their training, wrestlers going to the UFC, we know that you are wired a certain way to be a fighter. Like, they're just wired differently. They're not like other athletes. And the wrestlers, the first time I ever experienced this was, these guys were just, they were maniacal with their training. It went against all laws of sports science. And what I saw, because I was the only non-wrestler in the wrestling sauna, because I used to love the sauna way back then, back when I was like 14, 15, 16 years old.
Yeah, we did that right before. People are like, what's the sauna reference? We did that right before the podcast. The sauna and a cold plunge.
Yeah.
Mandatory.
I learned when I was in there, there was this coach. I want to say his name is Coach Mamir. But he was, you know, kind of stocky, shredded coach. And he used to, and then Coach Frazier, all these guys are like just packed in there like sardines. And they're all cutting weight. And they would do
jumping rope in there or something?
No, there's no, they would bring like an Aerodyne in there sometimes. And they would put like plastics on and train. I've seen it all. These guys are just, they were insane. Like, they were shredded. Like, they were peeled. It was like saran wrap over their skin, right? It was just like unbelievable. And these guys were just incredible. So what I saw was, he would give these speeches about the mental toughness that was required to be a warrior and win in wrestling. I really wish we had like microphones in there or video back then, because it was so powerful to see this group of men all just like drenched and like completely exhausted, go like 45 minutes in the sauna, leave, wrap themselves in hot towels, drink hot tea, and then go back in there again. And the Mamir is like literally standing by the door. No one can get in or out. Like, once you're in, you're locked in. I'm not cutting weight here. I'm just so scared. I don't want to say anything. I'm just tucked away in the corner. But that's where I learned so much, is listening to their stories about perseverance, about strength, about confronting your own demons, about what is required when you are completely operating on empty. Like, these athletes are so dehydrated. They have no food in their system. They don't have enough water in their system. And they have to go and wrestle another human being for like an hour or two during training. And so I just like, that's the kind of mindset that I want. I want that type of hunger and desire embedded in me, because I want to bring that type of intensity into my world. Because my world at the time, it didn't seem like it was that cool. Like, I loved it, don't get me wrong. But I was fascinated by that warrior fighter mentality. And so I brought that in, and it taught me so much. I had, and it created so much respect for collegiate, for high school, for Olympic wrestling, and then obviously athletes who go on to fight in, you know, things like the UFC and beyond.
I remember in high school, one of my good friends was a wrestler, and I'd say, hey man, like, come by after school. And he's like, okay, I'm going to be a little bit late because I got to do some weight cutting stuff. And I remember once waiting for him because he needed a ride. And he's like, in the shower with the steam on, wearing garbage bags duct taped to him, jumping rope. Obviously, it's so bad for you, but you need to make weight, so you got to do your thing. And it was just an incredible thing to witness, because I thought, I'm never going to put myself through something like that. And he secretly loved it. It was like, he just, because he wasn't really actually that good in school. He was kind of one of those like troubled kids. But man, when he got on the wrestling mat, he was a fucking demon.
Yeah.
And you could tell this was like his outlet, where he was like he wasn't blowing it, right? This is like the one thing where he's like, I'm going to be the best at it. I'm wondering, is this one of the reasons you used to, I know you used to overtrain like crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you used to do stuff like incline sprints where it's, now your coach would say, do not do this. You are just getting rid of muscle you need for the race. And you're just like, screw that. I'm going to run up a hill until I can't get out of the hole or whatever it is. It seems like you got addicted to getting better and to the pain / the endorphins from the pain. Is that what's going on here? Like, what was that all about?
Extreme training back then and overtraining just came from an old school mentality of just doing more work than everybody else. I think now we've got all these amazing devices to measure our sleep, our REM, our recovery, our cortisol levels, blood levels. And we were doing blood tests and such back then. The coaches used it to write our training programs to modify how we are responding to certain levels and amounts of stress that we're placing on the system. Right? So stress plus rest equals an amazing result. Stress plus no rest, you know, stress plus stress plus stress plus a little bit of rest is not enough. So back then, it was, for me, it was just compounding huge amounts of volume and consistency of intensity. I would say 80% of my career, I most likely was overtrained and or in a state where we were doing the wrong types of training. The mentality just comes from just being so insatiably hungry for improvement and also feeling like I could just never take a day off. Mm-hmm. We had days, like recovery days. So like when I was training, let's call it the last 5 years of training, Saturday afternoon and all of Sunday was on your own. Like there was no training that day. It was complete recovery. But I would almost always do an easy recovery jog mm-hmm. for like a half an hour and then go in the sauna. Always. Like that was what I did always.
Not the worst.
No, it's great. But I think today, if I could redo it, you can go so far with so much less because you're doing the right types of training mixed with the right types of recovery. So the U.S. national training speed skating team today monitors their sleep and their responses to certain levels of training. And if they're seeing this over the course of 7 days, and on that eighth day, there's a very hard workout, if you didn't respond appropriately, they actually will back you down at mm-hmm. risk of injury.
Sure. No, that makes sense. So looking at your HRV or what, your Aura ring
it's pretty amazing.
Stats.
Yeah. Even the way they lift weights, right? A lot of injuries in sport actually happen not even on the field of play. I mean, football is different, mm-hmm. boxing is different, but like a lot of times they're happening because like you just literally like an inch too forward or an inch too back on a deadlift or on a back squat. It changes everything. So they monitor everything in real time.
I've heard you got some pre-race rituals. Left skate goes on first.
Yeah, that's right.
I've seen this stuff in baseball or whatever, right? They've got to have their... Is it superstition or is this just the less things you think about, the better off you are? Like, what's going on?
It's habit and routine.
Okay.
So less superstition for sure. I think like put the left skate on first, then the right skate on. And for me, if I did it the opposite for some reason, which it never happened, but it did once in a while, I'd have to restart the whole process.
So that's a little bit, that's what I'm talking about, right? Like that's a little, you have to read, that's almost like, I don't want to say OCD because I don't want to make
OCD.
Light of it, but it's a little OCD.
No, yeah. It's 100% OCD and it's 100% attention to detail. I would also warm up a very particular way. I remember I heard it once from Bonnie Blair, who's this famed long track speed skater. Mm-hmm. And Bonnie had said that she would warm up and cool down the exact identical way, no matter if it was the Olympic final for her race or it was a local state meet that didn't matter. And she wanted to replicate that because that's the one controllable element that she could have no matter what the other exterior environment was. And she used to always tell me, she's like, Apollo, I want to tell something to you. The 1,000 meter or the 500 meters, whatever it is that you're racing, is the exact same distance at the Winter Olympics as it is in the local meet mm-hmm. when there's no one watching, there's no one in the stands. It's the exact same distance and you are the exact same person. So why would you change anything just because you're in this environment? So I wanted to create a system that was duplicatable over time. And I leaned on that. A lot of people talk about these things today where they say like, don't rely upon your willpower and your desire and your motivation, inspiration. Instead, rely upon or fall back upon the systems that you've created that you can always know are reliable. So the system that we created was, I warm up like this, I get ready like this, and I put on my skates like this. Always the same way.
You got a special knot as well for the skates, is that true?
Yeah, you would tie your skates a certain way in a certain level of tightness, and I would like test it by leaning back and forth to put pressure.
You got a bandana ritual though too, right?
I had a bandana ritual, you know.
That's a lot of stuff. You're stacking it up.
I mean, yeah, same thing. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you do this, but I do this, I still do this today. I fold the clothes that I'm going to wear tomorrow. Everything that I have today, from the workouts that I want to do today to the clothes that I wear like here with you now, this is all planned from yesterday.
So this was laid out on the bed or whatever.
It was folded, laid out, socks. It was jeans, sweatshirt, socks, underwear, belt.
All on top, like a little clothing
on
pyramid.
On the dresser, okay? And then I have a workout set, and then I have another workout set. I still do that today.
That's so funny.
Back then, it was just to save time.
Sure.
So this is what I don't want to do. I don't want to ever be having a conversation with myself around like, should I wear this or should I wear this today? How do I think this? Like, no, dude, like this was all yesterday's discussion of like, this is what you're wearing. I have like a checklist of things that I want to accomplish as priorities for the day or intentions per se. So like, if these are the intentions that I have today and these are the things that would make today amazing, remove all the possibility of arguing with myself about anything else that's not in line with the priorities. So say no to everything else and just make it from step one, step two, step three. Step one, wake up. Great. First step is done. Step two, close. Done. Put that on. Step three, this. Just create a system, right?
So just don't use any cognitive resources trying to decide what you're going to wear. It's already on the bed.
Yes. Or I could just wear the same thing every day.
Yeah. Once you have kids, that's what happens, right? People are like, what's up with the dad jeans? Nah, forget it. There's only dad jeans now. Tell me about the big yawn before the race. People are like, oh, this is him oxygenating. I'm like, I don't know, man. Is this a, is it a nervous yawn?
It was probably a little bit of a nervous yawn, and then it became a habit, mm-hmm. and then it became this OCD thing. I felt like, and this is what someone was trying to explain to me, they were saying that when you yawn, it's like this preparatory phase for your body about to go do something that's very high mm-hmm. aerobically based. And so it also was extremely relaxing. So, you know, before a really big race, your heart rate is kind of spiked a little bit, even though it's not in training, it's, you know, now in a competition. But the yawning was like a reset mechanism to say like bring that down here, because this level here is where you're highly attentive and you're highly cognizant of your surroundings, but you're also really relaxed. To me, that flow state is so important to be in. So it's not like being over-caffeinated, but you're in this like highly alert but deep and relaxed state.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's like my fascinations with like big cats and the way that they spend most of their time just kind of basically being lazy. But then they actually, when they're up, you see how focused they are. They're mm-hmm. so, they can't see anything else. They're just focused on what they're trying to go kill. I wasn't trying to kill anybody, but like as like a lion or like a big cat, I was trying to imagine myself as like filling my lungs up with all this oxygen, prepping the system to be able to, because I'm about to go race really hard, to expand and contract, expand and contract.
Tell me about this massive crash where you ended up taking a silver medal. I think this was that the one where you got a big cut?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the men's 1,000 meters. It was my first Olympic final in Salt Lake City for the first time ever. I was a favorite in this race. I was in the lead with like a quarter lap remaining. An athlete falls into the side of me. We all go crashing down. The whole other athletes also went crashing down, except for one athlete who was about a half a lap behind, Stephen Bradbury from Australia. He crosses the line, finish first, because we all fell down. Mm-hmm. I scramble to get to my feet, throw my skates across the finish line. It was a wild race because A, I had expected to win this race. Mm-hmm. B, I had told myself I'm about to win this race right before I fell. I felt like at that time that like something happened where the race was taken from me.
You got robbed because some dude fell into you.
It felt unfair. And I remember like being confused, and I rushed off the ice. I ripped my racing suit down, and there was a big gash in my left leg from the collision of the hitting the pads with my back. My right leg came and basically came just almost like a little knife with the edge of the blade into my left.
How sharp are those skates? They're really sharp?
Yeah, I mean they're diamond polished, so you could literally shave with them.
Wow.
Yeah, so in walks my sports physio, Brent. He looks at me with this crazy look in his eye. He's like, that was the most incredible race I've ever seen. Like, I can't believe you got up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, I'm thinking about this the entirely different way. I was thinking like pointing the finger in my head. Mm-hmm. I was already like, I have to go back and watch the tape to see what happened. Who took me down? Mm-hmm. And what I realized was at that moment, there was a very clear choice to make. I could either play that game of victim. I could play that game of I was done wrong. Or I could celebrate, which I can't control any of those variables anymore. I had to surrender. I had to accept, even though I was not happy with the result. I want a different color of the medal. I didn't want silver. The color of the medal was gold. Mm-hmm. That was the color that was destined for me and that was taken from me. Mm-hmm. But now I'm with this silver medal. And it was the first medal that I ever won. And my dad found me as I was getting stitched up. And he's like, you did it. And that was amazing. And I was too young and too naive to know, I think, what he was really saying. So someone had asked me, you know, Paul, what does it feel like to have lost the gold?
Yeah, the reporter said, mm-hmm. what does it feel like to lose the gold that way, is what she said.
I think I said something like, I don't think that I lost the gold, I won the silver.
Yeah, that's what you said.
And that is a really powerful metaphor for my life today, mm-hmm. where you work so hard at something and you feel so deserving to win that something. But for you being in this hyper zoomed in micro environment, you can't see or zoom way out to see like, I don't know why I'm going through this process right now, but later on in my life, this is incredibly powerful. That today out of 8 medals is my absolute favorite medal that I ever won. It's the most impactful, the most meaningful, and the most important in my entire career. And it wasn't gold. It's hard for people to comprehend that. But I think the silver medal is actually probably what you get most of your life outside of kids, mm-hmm. right? The kids is probably your gold no matter what. Silver or even bronze, or maybe no medal, is probably most likely what most people are going to experience. And I think, how do we learn from that experience? Create an acceptance mechanism to say, even that, look, you can be deeply unhappy and unsatisfied with the result, right? Which mm-hmm. which I was. but I also accepted it, I came to terms with it, and I surrendered to that outcome. That outcome is what it is, and forever in the history books, it is going to be written that I was silver, not gold. It's not going to have an asterisk and say, oh,
but he got knocked
because
down.
He was knocked down or he fell down. No one cares. It doesn't matter. 100 years from now, no one cares anyway about me, like 100 years. Like, I don't even exist anymore. I'm just like anybody else. But maybe now, maybe 5 years, right? Who knows? I didn't say this back then, but like now I can look back and say that was so powerful and meaningful. A, it represented a lot of what we as a country, I think, went through at that time, right? The attack on the World Trade Centers in New York, thinking America was like almighty, number one, and all of a sudden we're like brought to a knee and we live in this kind of fear state and we can either choose to stay in that fear state. I don't want to travel. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to live this kind of freedom-based life that I have been given. Life has given me a gift to live in this environment. And I don't want to do those things anymore. Or we can make a turn and say, you know what? I accept what just happened. I will analyze those things and make sure it never happens again. But I also want to be able to move forward in my life with the same amount of gratitude and appreciation. And so my next race, I won gold. Mm-hmm. But that race was so important to me because it just, I think about that race today. You want something, you don't get it. What are you going to do? Many times in our life, we are not going to get what we think we deserve, what we want. We feel like something happened outside of our control and we can stay in this state of like pain. You suffer because you no longer want to accept that. The only way to move past that is to accept it, settle into how you can grow from this experience. And then you can do two things, right? So it depends, and this is my fundamental belief. Depending on your personality, you can take that emotional state of like emotional pain and resentment or anger, and you can learn to harness that as power for yourself. You lean on that emotion, right? Just like I did in not making that first Olympic team and feeling ridiculed by the other parents and coaches who were saying, oh, he's a lost statistic. Mm-hmm. He just a has-been. That kid didn't have what it takes. He cracked under pressure. And hearing that or using that in a way to say like, I never want to feel that ever again. And I'm fundamentally convinced that most great athletes around the world have some semblance of that experience in their life to where, you know, Michael Jordan and the way that he approached his opponents and creating his own kind of internal enemies with them, these like conflicts that didn't even exist sometimes, right. The way that Kobe was a bit abrasive towards his teammates, but he created this psychology that was now known as the Mamba mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whatever it might be, these are really powerful moments and experiences. And so if you have pain, if you have suffered, if you have these emotional experiences in your life that detract away from your own happiness, you can either live in that state forever or you can use it as a lever to continue giving you this fuel, giving you this fuel. And I say the two types of personalities because some people can do that really well. Other people, they fail when they do that. Our upbringings teach us a different way.
Sure.
Some people are Jocko Willink and David Goggins people. Mm-hmm. Some people are not. Right. And so if you're not, there's probably components of that psychology that are very powerful, but there's maybe perhaps a different avenue in which creates action for you. So determining what actually speaks to you as a person to develop a set of systems that you can rely upon, I think is a fundamental priority for anyone going into the new year, right? Whether it's Christmas, whether it's January 2023, as you set forth these new systems for yourself to lean upon, they need to be done in a way that harnesses both the emotional experiences you've had mixed with if you want to be intentional about the next phase of your life. You cannot control the outcome. What you can control is the input. And so if the input is going to be these types of things, right, and I'm receiving this information, and if it's not being conducive, you need to stop accepting that as an input. So just like when I was skating back in the day, I was able to use my fear of failure in a way that was so powerful, it became a superpower. But over long enough durations of time, it also became toxic.
That I can understand. I mean, being driven by a fear of failure, it seems like most athletes are driven by wanting to win. But if you're driven by a fear of failure, I mean, isn't that feelings of an inadequacy? I mean, how do you, that would be toxic over time.
I think Phelps loved to win. But I think he actually hated to lose. And I think Peter Attia was talking about this the other day, and he was saying something along the realm of Phelps can go to a local meet. He's training through the meet, so he's not peaked. He's tired. He's not shaved. He's like wearing like not the best suit for like optimal drag. Mm-hmm. But he somehow figures out how to win in those races. And he's like, I couldn't figure out why or how he's doing it. And he finally realized, Peter finally realized that he just hates to lose so much. It's psychologically painful for him to deal with the aftermath than actually do that. And I think that's the same for a lot of athletes is, yes, I mean, we all love to win. Winning feels amazing. It's the positive head nod that like you're on the right track. You're worthy, right? Mm-hmm. This is what we do when we see someone.
Yeah, it's a validation, yeah.
But I think more so, like I used to feel this incredible sense of relief after competitions.
It's like win or lose?
Win or lose, especially win, obviously. But sure. Like I just like relief of like that it's over. This like emotional stress is like over for a second.
Yeah, okay.
And
I can relate to that a little bit.
Yeah, but I think like the most optimal flow state is when you're no longer worrying about outcome, right? So that's what I experienced in speed skating was I felt like when I skated my absolute best, the metric and the goal was to win these races, but I was never thinking about like, I must win, I must win, I must win. Instead, the focal point was on this process. Are you in the right position? Are you in second? Are you in third? Like, when do you want to make a move? Like, are you relaxed? Like, just being in this almost like this constant flow state where I'm not forcing anything. It's just actually happening in real time. So there's, in speed skating, we have this unique component of if you lean into the corner, coming out of the corner. So you lean into basically to your left as you exit the corner, it's going to carry your speed even more. And then as you lean into the entrance of that next corner, that's when you feel the most amount of pressure on your legs. And so during these moments, most athletes lean out a little bit to take that pressure off, which causes them to slow down. And so there's this really fine line between trying too hard and not trying hard enough. It's like the 85 to 95% rule. So if you're going 100% all out, you're probably trying too hard in speed skating. It's really interesting. So if you can go 90 to 95%, you will probably skate a little bit faster, but it feels so much easier. Flow state's like that. You're trying just hard enough, and then you just get in a state where it's almost automatic, and then it almost becomes easy. And that was very addictive.
What's this about you putting your medals in basically a sock drawer so you can, and this is a quote I think from you, train as if you'd never won anything.
So there's another fear that I had where after I had won, you know, the first set of medals, I had never wanted to have them on display as if this was like a proud achievement that I could rest upon, like rest my laurels on. And instead it was like, well, train as if you're poor, train as if you have nothing, train as if you are the underdog and create an environment where you always stay hungry. That was taught to me through the wrestlers in the Olympic Training Center who had kind of scoffed and looked down upon these athletes that had made a significant sum of wealth. And by the way, these concepts to me are now wrong, but just gotta, this is 20 plus years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so back then it was like, if you live this like soft cushion life, you were not a hardened person. There's like some psychology there, right? And so I was like, well, I'm not gonna move out of the Olympic Training Center. I'm gonna stay here and live in the moment and live around these other athletes that haven't won, that are just as hungry, that are grinding every single day. I could see the fire in their eyes and they hadn't yet made it, quote. And so that was inspiring.
This is the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Apollo Ono. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. If you're going through a tough time, you are not alone and you don't have to deal with it on your own. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, it's flexible, it's affordable, it's entirely online. If you're still skeptical, the BetterHelp app has over 93,000 reviews on the iPhone app with 4.8 out of 5 stars. From the beginning, you're able to narrow down what kind of therapist you want by answering questions and building your own profile. This allows the portal to set you up with a therapist that best matches your needs. Therapy is vulnerable work, not going to lie. BetterHelp understands you're not going to mesh with everyone. I've heard from a lot of you who tried BetterHelp that you've switched a couple of times to different therapists, totally normal. Just let BetterHelp support know. You don't have to notify the therapist. You don't have to have that awkward conversation. They will just handle it for you. You can also choose from email, chat, phone, or video sessions. For me, I just have an easier time opening up when I'm in the comfort of my own home, talking over the phone. I don't really want to do a video session a lot of the time. Take this as a sign to give therapy a try.
If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/Jordan to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored by Athletic Greens. Jen and I take AG1 by Athletic Greens pretty much every single day. We add a scoop of AG1 to a bottle of water, shake it up, drink it up in the morning. We started taking AG1 because, I'll be honest, a lot of times I'm eating whatever crap my kid has left over on the plate, not necessarily the healthiest stuff. We want to make sure we're getting the nutrients we need in a way that's easy enough for our body to absorb, not chomping on 30 different pills. AG1 is like all-in-one nutritional insurance. It's cheaper and easier than getting all the different supplements yourself, as if you would even bother. Each scoop has 75 vitamins, minerals, whole food sourced superfoods, probiotics, adaptogens. There's no need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. No GMOs, no nasty chemicals, no artificial stuff in there. I have tried many of these types of products. You usually have to cover the taste with putting in a smoothie or some other ingredients with AG1. The flavor is surprisingly good, has that slight green flavor, but it's not super bitter. It's not overpowering. One scoop with water, all alone by itself. Reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition, especially heading into the flu and cold season, which if you have kids, is every single damn day.
To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Jordan. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Jordan to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
This episode is also sponsored in part by Simply Safe. Winter is the time where property crimes like burglaries and package theft spike. You'd think the burglars would be working from home in the cold too, but I guess not. They're working from your home. If you're traveling, make sure to keep your home secure with Simply Safe. We have been longstanding customers of Simply Safe. The system is very easy to set up, very affordable. You plug it in, you connect to your Wi-Fi. It's got cellular in case your Wi-Fi goes kaput. It's also got a battery backup if your power goes kaput. Simply Safe has been awarded the best home security system of 2022 by U.S. News and World Report a third year in a row. We love Simply Safe's variety of high-tech sensors, HD security cameras. You can live stream them, look at it on your phone if you want to. There are also hazard sensors to detect fires and floods and other threats, which is coming in surprisingly and unfortunately handy here in California these days. Plus 24/7 professional monitoring. Knock wood. Jen put that to the test by accidentally opening up the garage door and scaring the crap out of the kids. And we instantly got a call from Simply Safe's agents to make sure we were okay. And in an emergency, 24/7 professional monitoring agents use Fast Protect technology exclusively from Simply Safe to capture critical evidence and verify the threat is real so you get priority police response. I wonder what the critical evidence is. Maybe there's like, here is a blood sample from the wall. This is a real emergency. Anyway, Jen, drop them the code.
Customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes at simplysafe.com/Jordan. Go today and claim a free indoor security camera plus 20% off your order with interactive monitoring. That's simplysafe.com/Jordan. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
If you like this episode of the show, I invite you to do what other smart and considerate listeners do, which is take a moment and support our amazing sponsors. All of the deals, discount codes are all in one place. JordanHarbinger.com/deals is where you can find them. You can also use the AI chatbot to find deals and promo codes. Just go to JordanHarbinger.com, use the AI chatbot and ask it for the promo code. And well, it hopefully we'll come up with our promo code. Thank you so much for supporting those who support us. Now for the rest of my conversation with Apollo Ono.
Oh, yeah.
You just don't forget how many people are right on your ass. Take your foot off the gas. You just see these guys. You're like, well, wait a minute. This guy's coming out here. He's in the proverbial parking lot in Seattle at 3 o'clock in the morning, skating his ass off. And if you're like, I got a silver and a couple golds, that's fine. I'll go down in history. You will give up. And I think you did this in the Way to Gold documentary. You said the difference between a gold medal and nothing in speed skating, it's a snap. Were you clapping?
Yeah. Basically like that.
Yeah. And that's gold versus nothing.
That's gold versus nothing. So like crazy. I think it was I don't know which race, but it was like 4/1000ths of a second sometimes, you know, 2/100ths of a second, 3/100ths of a second. Like you just think about that. So people ask, well, why do you train so hard for so long, for so many years, that 4-year journey or that 8-year journey? What does that look like for you? And I think a lot of that comes down to, well, the race is only, you know, 40 seconds long or a minute and a half long. Mm-hmm. Anything could happen in that middle of that race. But if you had just missed gold or making the final by 2/100ths of a second, you start to question your reality of existence of how much effort did I put in during this previous 4 years? Mm-hmm. Should I have partied that much? Should I have eaten poorly? That's where these routines and systems become so obsessive, because you know the smallest of minute details can cause you to win or not.
It's just a ton of pressure.
You know what's crazy is like all this entire conversation, it feels like to me, we're talking about a person from a long time ago.
Sure.
Because I don't feel like that person today. I have components and times where that person comes back to the front.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, Paul, like that little inner animal is still here. Don't forget, you got to feed me sometimes. Like,
yeah.
And you need to go push yourself in the gym or go into solitude or whatever it might be. Like there's these moments where it's this reminder that I need to go towards the hard things. Because I've had like success in my life. I've been blessed enough to be able to see and experience all these unique areas of the world mm-hmm. and people and dynamics. And then there's moments where my dad always say, Apollo, you have to like, you got to come back down to earth,
mm-hmm.
bring it back to the basics, right? The most simplistic thing is like your health and the priorities around yourself and your family. Like that's all that you really need. It's really simple. Yes, you can have huge financial dreams, mm-hmm. huge dreams of what you think is going to give you the great life. And I think the reality is people, they find their purpose in all different types of meaning. And I think having those goals are important. So it keeps you on that purpose-driven life, right? You need some semblance of purpose of why you're doing what you're doing, or perhaps why you're suffering what you're suffering through. Just Viktor Frankl, I'm a huge proponent of what he has written and talked about so long, because what he's experienced was atrocities back during those Nazi concentration camps. But I think the silver lining from him surviving those things and experiencing and seeing those things is what we should be taking in today. A, life is this incredible gift. And so do not waste it on shit that is like just like not worthy of your time and energy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't serve you and who you want to truly become. Because when you're 80 and we have a conversation and I'm like, what do you regret? Or what are the things in your life that you wish you could have told yourself when you were 40, half your age of what you are today? By the way, I've asked a lot of people this who are older. My grandma just turned 103. And the answers vary from like, I wish that I stopped living a life for other people and I started living the life for myself.
Yeah, man.
So like with the way that social is, right? You're given, you're being fed this life and environment of you need to have this, you must do this, you must be here, you must date this, you must look like this in order for you to be happy, because that's the recipe. And we all know, I think, at the core, that's not really what gives you the most amount of fulfillment, happiness, progress, and purpose. That's why I think like taking the step back for a second, metaphorically climbing up onto that, you know, balcony to survey the landscape of where you thought that you were going and realize that you've been dissuaded by this fog of war because you're fighting this thing that's so small in components of your entire biggest life, right? And so we all live as if we have this infinite life, right? We take things for granted, we're grinding, and very natural human experience. I do this too. And I don't know, this is what helped me, dude, is like the more I can recognize and realize, A, life is a gift. Like I just had this incredible experience like recently with some friends of mine. Went to this concert. A friend of mine manages these like huge artists, right? These huge artists. And he's like, oh, you should come. I'll take care of you guys. Like gave us these like unique passes to like literally go anywhere we wanted in this place. It was mm-hmm. unbelievable. And then my friend looks at me and I was like, what are you doing? Why do you keep like looking around? And she's like, oh, I'm just thinking about all the people that bought all those tickets that are way up there in the back, way, way in the back, right? I'm like, well, what about it? And she's like, they're just happy to be here. They're just as happy as we are to be here. There's no difference. She was saying like, I'm so thankful to be able to experience this or that or anything that we're here in this moment. And so I was like, but that's so powerful. That is, you want real freedom? Stop wanting more.
That's
and
true.
It's super hard to have, right? Because that's how I'm what? Dude, well, I'm wired that way.
I was just talking about that this morning. I was like, oh, I wish that this and this and this was different. And my wife's like, okay, get out of that mode. Because I get in that mode where I'm like, oh, sure. I should have done this and I should be working on this other stuff. But it's just, I don't know. And it's like—
But that's also probably why you've been successful.
It's why I'm here, yeah. So I need to be able to get the lift and then switch that off and then glide, right? That's the tricky part though, is being like, hey— Maybe don't beat yourself up about the silver medal.
So you know what's helped me? Because I can relate to that. Mm-hmm. I can relate to this like dissatisfaction with staying still.
Yeah.
Right? Like I feel like I'm not moving. Therefore, I feel like I'm going backwards.
I'm squandering the opportunity by not working right now or whatever.
Oh, you only get one life. You got to maximize every minute of your life. And what's helped me is actually scheduling in several times per year to take time where I totally decompress and I'm just there being grateful for that moment. I'm not worrying about what I'm doing over here. I'm not working on things I'm not supposed to work on. I'm actually shutting off the system. I'm getting off the treadmill. I'm getting off of the life treadmill. And that's when I have the most epiphanies in my life, when I recognize the most important things.
You must have, when you were younger, you know, viewing winning at all costs, I assume, as normal. that must have cost you relationships. I mean, I assume dating, being a boyfriend, husband, whatever, is actually impossible when you're focused on something like that. It seems like you've changed your tune about this. You're mentioning future kids.
Yeah.
So at least you're thinking a little bit about the fact that, like, you might need a partner at some point in order to do that.
I have two experiences, right? Number one, I was raised by a single parent, you know, my whole life, my dad. So I have no relationship with my mom. I never met my mom. So I have this, like, Japanese, like, samurai warrior mentality that my father raised me out. Then I surrounded myself in this old school mentality of trying to be like these wrestlers that I looked up to and admired. I wanted to grab onto their toughness, their mental psychology towards how they train and how they view the sport. So there was like no room for this like compassion and empathy and softness and understanding and vulnerability that we can talk about today. The identification of what we deem to be a great leader today has all of those qualities. It has strength, it has leadership, it has all these components. But it also has empathy, compassion, understanding, humanizing. You know, the greatest leaders during the height of the pandemic, when people were in pure chaos and had no idea what to believe and not to believe, the greatest leaders stepped up to their teams and said, like, I'm human like you. I'm struggling like you. I want to help you. Let us help each other. That is a great leader. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was just like, no, you are stoic.
Stoic,
you show no pain. You show no emotion. You are a leader. There's a separation between you and the rest of the people there. And I think that authoritative component is dissolving. And so same thing with my growing up around these like fractured relationships, which, by the way, were completely my fault, almost entirely. My lack of prioritizing a relationship, my lack of creating an environment of like great communication. And I'm still learning today. I'm far from perfect in any of the things that I'm involved with, right? Or these personal relationships that I have.
But you don't seem like the emotionally stunted guy that you read about in the book during your competitive days.
I feel like a different person.
Yeah.
I feel like a different person. And I keep in touch with several teammates that I used to train with for years. And they even tell me, they're like, Apollo, you are so radically different than what we used to remember you as an athlete. And I'm like, really? Was I really like that? They were like, yeah, you were like kind of scary. You were like kind of scary. Like you literally showed up like a machine. You never had an off day. Like you were always there and you demanded this like level of excellence from everybody that was there. And it was almost this like intensity that was a bit aggro, right? And I'm like, I'm not that big of a guy. Like I can't, how am I intimidating?
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's the energy that you project. And so as I've done a lot of work on myself, I have a huge gap in my life in terms of my upbringing. I didn't have like a great mom. I had motherly figures around in my life, but they weren't there every day. I didn't learn a lot of these things. Like I didn't learn in the relationships. So I'm like stunted. I'm 40 years old, but I feel like I'm like 25.
Yeah.
You know, in certain areas of my life. I'm still kind of going through these motions, but to me, it's the intention of saying like, okay, I accept you for who you were, Apollo. I accept you for these mistakes that you've made. And now it's up to you, it's a responsibility to yourself to begin setting forth a plan to go and explore how you can become the person that you want to be to your future kids, to your friends, to your loved ones, to the environment that you get yourself into. So whether it's I'm at an event and I'm networking with friends or with people that I don't know, if I'm going to dinner with people and I want to be highly engaged, if I'm meeting someone for the first time, or if I'm on a plane, I'm alone, I'm traveling, and this person next to me is kind of gives you that look and maybe they want to say something and want to ask you a question and you just want to like stay in your own pod. How do I go outside of that comfort zone? Because that's where I know the greatest amount of growth has come. And I'm telling you, every time I have gone out of my comfort zone repeatedly, the result was extraordinary. Every time. So I hate doing stuff on my own to like, we were talking about like in the sauna, like installing insulation.
Yeah.
You know why? You know why I said that?
Yeah.
Because I installed insulation in my friend's place. Like, dude, like, I don't have to, like, I just pay somebody.
What are you doing? Yeah, yeah.
But I'd never done it before. It was like so foreign to me. So like, I did this whole thing. I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Home Depot. I'm going to buy this stuff, get the gloves, get the mask. I'm going to get like the thing that cut the insulation. I'm going to measure it. I'm going to climb up into the attic, hands on my knees. I'm going to tuck it in there.
That's what my wife does. She loves the gym.
You're a badass.
And my wife,
that's awesome.
Jen's always doing stuff like that. She's like, I'm going to make a table. I'm like, just buy it. No, I'm going to make a table for Legos for the kids.
That's my secret. Like, tell us something that probably you love to do that no one believe you. I'm like, I like to watch home improvement videos. Very sexy.
I like to install insulation in friends' homes.
Yeah.
If you need your home re-insulated, call Apollo Ono. Olympic insulation.
Apollo Addicts.
Yeah. Let's talk about retirement, the end of the Olympic career. Because athletes, the careers, it sounds like they usually end in ways that are not ideal for the athlete, right? When these careers end, especially if they end suddenly, there's a loss of identity, maybe even less than retiring from a job. It's almost like getting fired because it's like, well, that wasn't the ending I wanted.
Yeah.
Maybe you did come in dead last because you tore something and now you're just never going to be in the same place again. Or it's your last Olympics because you're 30 and you can't do it anymore because gymnastics don't allow for that or whatever it is. We've talked about these sort of changes with Maya Shankar, episode 733. We'll link to that in the show notes. But what does it feel like when you're ending your career? It's got to be very disoriented. And I know you said it felt like you were going to die, which sounds hyperbolic, but I guess maybe isn't.
I can only speak from my personal experiences in the conversations that I've had with my peers, specifically Olympic. I've talked to some people who were like in the military about their transition, a lot of similarities there. Mm-hmm. There's a piece of you that feels like has died and you're trying to figure out who else is there remaining. And if you not train that other self, these other facets of your personality, your curiosities, it all feels like you're starting over. No one wants to climb to the top of the mountain and then go right back down to the bottom and start from scratch. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like. And I've found the more, especially in the Olympic space, I think in the Olympic space, there's less cushion. You didn't really go to school. You didn't study, most athletes that I know. And then you go through this period of like trying to reclaim an identity that needs to be harnessed to your strength, but not completely embodied. So Apollo Ono as the Olympic champion, there's core attributes that are very, very transferable to whatever it is that I'm doing next. But there's certain things about that person that I no longer believe are serving me in the best possible light moving forward. I didn't know that I had all these other curiosities in my life or what these strengths were outside of the sport because I didn't care. Mm-hmm. I burned the ships. I jumped out of the airplane with no parachute. I just was like, that was the power that I had. It was like, this is what I'm going after. And there is no plan B. There's only plan A because plan A has to work. It must work or else I don't exist. Mm-hmm. So when it was time to retire, and I'm one of the lucky ones, I could fall back on all these speaking engagements and like sponsorship deals.
You had endorsements and stuff.
I was able to make some money, not professional athlete money, let's be very clear, but I could make some money. And then it opened up my eyes in the world to like all these other business possibilities and opportunities that existed. So I started pursuing this curiosity, but deep inside, there was a significant loss of identity. So this is what's interesting. If you had asked me in 2010, 8 months after those Olympic Games, after my last Olympic Games, and you said like, Paul, like, what do you want? I would have said, all I want is just to feel normal. I just like don't want to be recognized for a second. I just like want to walk in to like an airport, not get stopped. I like just want to go to a restaurant, not feel like all eyes are on me. And it's hard to believe because today I have complete anonymity. It was so visceral because I had to lose everything that I was told and given the approvals of who I was. This is why we will celebrate you as a person, is because of your accolades as esports.
Sure.
And you aren't anything else. This is who you are.
We define, in the West especially, we define ourselves by our occupation. I mean, I certainly do.
Absolutely. And that's understandable. But we know that beneath that is a layer of context and texture that is far more complex than just the title of what you do in this particular moment in time. You are made up of all of the life experiences and things that have made you who you are. And so at that point in time, I didn't know who I was yet. I needed to go explore, fail, you know, understand what my true north was. Dude, it took me like 10 years to really understand what I really want to do in my life.
It would be so disorienting. They call it the great divorce. I think I mentioned that earlier in the show. Yeah. And it sounds so jarring and traumatizing. In the book, you mentioned FOPO, fear of other people's opinions. That, you know, that would also, I don't know if haunt me is quite the right word, but you said in The Weight of Gold, 80% or more athletes go through post-Olympic depression, which is, and that includes winners. This isn't like people who didn't medal and they're sad because their life culminated and they didn't get what they wanted. This is people who have won. This is you, Michael Phelps, guys who are highly, you're the Is it, you're the most highly decorated winter Olympian in American history. Phelps, I think, is the most highly decorated, at least in swimming or possibly of all
in the world.
Time in the world. And these guys are like, well, you guys are like, oh, I'm depressed. And it's like, what are you talking about? You should be on top of the world. And they're like, that's the problem. Everyone's telling us that, that we're supposed to be on top of the world. How do you go from walking into the Olympic opening ceremonies one day and then, what was the girl's name? Lolo Jones. She's making a smoothie for somebody at probably like Equinox or something.
Yeah.
And her race comes on and the guy's like, is that you on TV? And she's like, do you want cilantro in there? You want avocado? And she's like, yeah, making a freaking smoothie. You're just dropped into reality. There's no mooring whatsoever.
Mm.
It's like, you got gold. Okay, bye.
It's jarring for sure. Career changes, relationship loss that you face, loved one, health, finance, rarely happen on your own terms. Mm-hmm. These things happen out of left field, and now you have to deal with it. That was a large part of like the way I decided to write this book, Hard Pivot.
Sure.
Was I felt like there was a world of people who also were going through these identity shifts, where they were like, man, like, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know what I want. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how to start. That's like the typical like questions and answers, right?
Sure.
I only know how to do one thing for so long. I was good at that thing. Yeah. I can no longer do that thing anymore.
Like, who are you off the ice, basically? Right.
Who are you as like this like chat GPT in like 10 years, like takes over a lot of stuff. Like, yeah. Like who are you in this new era? A lot of this was like inquisitive. So like, I remember in like my early 30s and middle 30s I became much more inquisitive about like my life purpose, about mm-hmm. what I was doing, who I was spending time with, which direction in life was I going? Is this the right direction? It was very common amongst all of the peers, Olympic athletes that I talked to. Everyone felt lost. You went from being the best at something to literally feeling like you're 10 years behind in doing the same job as someone who's 10 years you're younger
sure.
in the same way. And that was really, really challenging. And so we all have to begin with this beginner's mind. A lot of this comes from this self-purported belief of, you know, what Michael Gervais, a good friend of mine, first gave me that idea around FOPO, this fear of other people's opinions. So how would you perform if you knew or you didn't care about other people's opinions? This is what you actually believe. Prove me wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say this, tell me that I'm wrong. Or I'm just going to say this and I don't care. This is what it is. And I think that there's a lot of strength that comes from behind that. And I lived in an environment where I was like sheltered in this bubble where like, hey, you have to act like this. This is the Olympic creed and the motto and the symbolism. And it felt artificial. I didn't feel like I could be human. I didn't feel like I could make a mistake. I didn't feel like I could pursue these things. And so it was highly resistant to me actually stepping out of that comfort zone. And what I realized very quickly was that I was able to adapt to the environments that I was around. So the more challenging, the more new these new endeavors or ideas or people that I would meet, they were so inspirational to me. They were so transformational. And that's why I became so addicted to hearing about someone's journey.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, tell me about when like no one believed in you.
Yeah.
What did you do? I want to know the conversation that you remember having with yourself when you started to question, is this the right path?
Mm-hmm.
Do I really want to do this? What made you keep going? What was the inner voice that was there? Was there an exterior motive? Was there an exterior person? What was that moment? How did you grab onto that? Because I think that we can apply that towards our life as we grow and harness the power that exists within.
It seems like it would be really tough to get your bearings. I know you've got the personal board of directors. Shaquille O'Neal actually has this too. He calls it the panel. Shaq, episode 691. Speak to that a little bit, because I think this is really helpful. If you're not an Olympian, it's also very helpful. I think every, especially young people, kind of need this in their life.
Yeah, so I mean, we've heard all different types of people and authors and podcasters talk about you are the sum of the five people that you hang out with.
Oh, yeah, that's a...
There's many people that have sent...
Jim Rohn had the original one, right?
And I think there's some truth there. I think that as you go into your career or business, right, either if you're an entrepreneur or you work for a corporation, whatever career path that you choose, if you were going to create a group of like two people or five people around you that have your best interests in mind, they're going to be transparent with you about the direction that you're going. They're going to hold you accountable when you need to be held accountable towards making promises to yourself that you want to do that you didn't do. They are there to lean on from not only advice, but also help uplift you in the times when you get a little bit wavy to hold you back up straight. And so the personal board of directors came from this, it was inspired by this leadership program that I took at Wharton, University of Pennsylvania, where we were placed into these groups of people, 5 and 7 people. And we talked about the importance of setting not only a board of directors for your company, because a lot of these CEOs and executives that were attending this program for 7.5 weeks were there. What is the perfect size board? And then others were saying, well, you should also have a personal board of directors. So doesn't matter what you do, you should have one person, 2 people, 5 people, whatever it might be. I think smaller is better, of people that you can have open communication with. And it's not all take. This is really, really important. You're not just calling them for advice always, right? There's got to be some kind of transference there. And sometimes people just want to help and that feels like the transference, right? There's this like going back and forth, like that person who's in a successful state feels like they have some duty and responsibility to help a younger person help grow and sidestep those landmines that they stepped on, right, to help you grow as well. The personal board of directors is really just to, like, if you were going to govern your life, how do you set up these star players around you that can work together in the best way possible? Not looking for all star players, right? But looking for the best types of players to work together as you assemble your team. And I found that to be really, really important. So I lean on these sports psychologists that I had for many, many years because they just seem, at least for me, they've known me since I was a kid. So I was 15, 14 years old. They've seen me grow. They've seen me go up and down these kind of variables of change. I have people that I know since I was 12 who know me as a person, seen me grow and change. Mm-hmm. And they know how aspirational I can get and they keep things in line and kind of back down to the earth. I can be so open with them. So if you're not communicating with anyone, you need to find someone who you can have these conversations with. To me, it's highly therapeutic. And then two, it's actually very beneficial. They're not perhaps giving you advice that you don't already know, but those simple reminders of, hey, Apollo, remember when we did those concentration exercises and training about staying focused and you were able to eliminate the world and its distractions for 5 minutes at a time? Well, before you go and write next, before you go and do a podcast next, before you go and do whatever next, that's training that is going to serve you. Oh, yeah, I'm not competing as an athlete anymore, but my brain still needs to be just as active as I pursue this next phase of my life. So how do I incorporate these things? So these reminders are really powerful.
Is it true you haven't laced up your skates since 2010?
I haven't skated properly on them. I have put the skates on. I think I did it for the Special Olympics a few times, but my skates are just like, you know, they're just out and on display.
They're in the drawer with the medals?
I put them on last year, end of last year, end of 2021, just to see what they felt like again. And I was like, oh, these are very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I was going to say, ice skates are always super uncomfortable. Yeah. It's like ski boots.
It's all carbon fiber.
Yeah. All right, you could auction them off for charity one day if you feel so inclined, I suppose. I was just curious because it seems like you'd miss it. Like maybe every winter you go around, do a lap around the Christmas tree in New York.
Oh, I miss it.
Yeah, I bet.
I miss it. So like I still go back to the Olympic Games. I do a lot of stuff with broadcasting with NBC. That to me is like a coming home reunion.
That's cool.
And then I also go to Utah. That's where the national team still trains today. So one of my closest friends, who was one of my coaches, is still the head coach there now. I'll go to Utah. You know, I'll be on the board side. Mm-hmm. Man, just like the smell of like those Zamboni fumes that are probably really toxic.
Super bad for indoor diesel.
Yeah. There's something like very special about like that feeling. And then I miss it, man. I tell you, like Olympic pursuit is really simple. I think I took it for granted when I was competing, but you have no responsibility other than yourself, you know, your team as well, but it's a very simple life. Like nothing goes in your body that doesn't help you propel yourself faster to be bigger, stronger, better, faster. You don't do any activities really outside the sport. Everything you do is related to you becoming a best version of yourself on the ice. All you do is like just hang out. And when you're not training, you're resting and getting ready for the next workout. People say like, oh, it sounds so intense. I'm like, I think it's all like
simplified though.
Just simplified. Like you don't do much. That's why I hear about people having kids and training and doing that stuff. Like, wow, I was gonna say,
if when do you have kids? It's the opposite of everything you just described with the simplicity and the doing only things for yourself.
Yeah.
I don't even understand how those two worlds could exist. That's like an oil and water kind of situation. Applause to anybody who manages to do that. Thank you for being so open about all this stuff, man. I think it's important because a lot of people look up to guys like you or people, athletes in general. And we think, oh, well, these guys have it all figured out. They got it all figured out. I think it's helpful for people to know that most of us are just driven by, in many ways, maybe our insecurities, trying to make sense of our lives, even if outwardly we look like we're on top of the world. So I really appreciate your candor and for coming all the way here and having a conversation with us. Really, really appreciate
it. Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I mean, for your like listeners who hear these stories among all the guests that come on, there's probably like reoccurring common themes mm-hmm. about everyone's experiences. As people go through the different phases of life, of growth, of loss, of pain, I think all of us pretty much want very similar things. And I think learning to understand yourself about why you are the way that you are, that self-acceptance component is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. Like looking in the mirror and going through that exercise of accepting exactly who you are and all your insecurities and failures and shortcomings, and then developing a plan about how you are going to live the next year, the next 2 years, the next 3 years, and then holding yourself accountable, creating systems that you can lean on when you forget, when you get distracted, when you get pulled in different directions that you can go back to, that set the stage again, remind you of what you're actually doing. There are certain systems that you can do. I actually rewrote the book, Hard Pivot, which is going to come out again next year, like a 2.0 version.
Oh, you rewrote it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we're putting in some interesting new kind of new learnings and simplified some things I think that needed to be kind of restated. That'll be really helpful to people. But again, like if there's one message that I can leave to people is that your choices to respond and react to the situations that you're meeting today are solely within your control. Solely. Whether you are hyper successful and you decide what you want to do next, whether you are failing miserable and you're deeply unhappy, or you feel like you're just floating and you're just like kind of like, everyone seems like they all have it around me. It's all noise. The person that actually creates momentum and progress is the one that doesn't listen to that voice unless it's using it for fuel to actually make progression and positive movement. That is within you. That's the power of the mind. So I've done it in my life in sport. I've done it in my life post-sport. I'm not perfect by any means, but I deeply love to see people win. And so everything that I dedicate myself towards today, my life mission is about how do we create a more open communication channel to create conversation that actually moves and inspires and reminds people of the superpowers that we actually really all have within.
I've got some thoughts on this episode, but before I get into that, we were humbled to have the opportunity to talk to the late Kobe Bryant for this interview just a few short months before the tragedy. Here's a preview with one of basketball's most iconic legends, Kobe Bryant.
I love the game. I love it. I didn't want to be away from it. I wanted to play all the time. I was 18, 21 years old. I wanted to play basketball. I was consumed with this quest of trying to be the best. I knew I wanted to win 5, 6, 7 yeah. championships. For me to come out and say that, people would think I was a lunatic. Negotiate with yourself. You know, what happens inside of here? Are you able to negotiate your way out of that little voice telling you it's not that important? Or does that little voice get the best of you? Remove the ego from this process. Just focus on the act. And when you do that, now you can look at actions and then you can truly improve. How can you lock in and get into that mental space where nothing else matters? The noise of the crowd doesn't matter. Whether you're cheering or booing doesn't matter. You're just completely locked in. How do you do that?
How do you not let demons of uncertainty get inside your head? Like when you tore your Achilles, are you not thinking like, uh-oh, how am I going to come back?
Oh, God, yeah. If you're nervous or scared about a situation, instead of being like, nah, there's nothing to be scared about, nothing to be scared about, oh, shit, there is.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's okay. You know, like you own it, you give it a hug, you embrace it, and now what are you going to do about it?
For more with Kobe Bryant, including how Kobe managed pressure in high-stakes situations and lessons Kobe learned from the people who are the best at what they do, check out episode 249 on The Jordan Harbinger Show. So glad we finally did this one. Been going back and forth with Apollo for something like 2 years here. I actually didn't realize how much Apollo and I had in common, although I never had a soul patch. In my defense, I dodged that bullet. You've heard my opinion on the Olympics. We even did a Skeptical Sunday about the Olympics. That was episode 676. I talk about why the games are kind of terrible, especially for athletes, host countries as well. His training story is just crazy. He used to run away from the Olympic training camps, sabotage himself in competition. Really fascinating. I also don't blame him for not lacing up his skates since 2010 or so. It sounds like a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. And I have to say, hanging out with Apollo, it's really inspiring. You can get a feel for his intensity and his competitive mindset, but you're not going to be put off by it. You can feel that he's competitive and he wants an edge and he works super hard,
but he's not competing with you. At least it doesn't feel that way while you're around him. And I really think that's a great way to be. We really clicked. I definitely consider him a friend at this point. And after the show, we got into a conversation in the car about how easy it is to get lost in winning, even if a win seems hollow, in spite of, and maybe even because of, just how important some of these Olympic wins especially might seem to the outside world. And at his level, the pressure to win all the time, it's like an external dictation of values, which I think all of us can relate to. People want us to be something that we aren't or that we almost are, and we feel pressure to conform to those expectations, even if it might make us miserable. And the hitch here is, it's actually easier to fall prey to this the closer you get to the win, because you feel like, well, I'm really close, I should do it, it's within my grasp. If I just worked a little harder or a little more, that's truly a recipe for disaster there. I can definitely relate when it comes to business and online influence and all that jazz. That really hit home for me. I really appreciated Apollo's candor and openness in this one as well. By the way, lots of practical mindset exercises in the book. We'll link to both of his books in the show notes. Dude really knows how to get the best out of himself. And I think a lot of what he says and recommends is just legit. One small example is the following. So get out a sheet of paper, make a list of the labels other people identify with you or what they say you are, right? So you might say, like, people might say, you're a lawyer, you're a podcaster, you're a father. Then later on, make a list of the labels you use for yourself. Now you'll see a lot of overlap, but a lot of differences as well. And it really does frame things in an interesting way, both in terms of your goals, how others might see you or expect you to be, what you think you are, what you think you appear, how you think you appear to others, what society might want you to become, the differences there, good or bad. Again, lots like this in the book, if you're into that sort of self-helpy, personal growth, reflective kind of thing. Did a few of those drills myself before the show and in conversation with Apollo, and I thought it was quite interesting. Again, big thanks to Apollo. All of his links, all of his stuff will be on the website in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com. Check out our ChatGPT chatbot. You can get promo codes, sponsors, any info from any episode of the show over at jordanharbinger.com/AI. And we're a few episodes behind, so you might not get today's episode if you're searching for it right now, but you'll get stuff that's, you know, a few weeks back. And we're constantly updating that, of course. Transcripts also in the show notes, videos on YouTube, advertisers, deals, and discount codes, all at jordanharbinger.com/deals. Please consider supporting those who support this show. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on Twitter and Instagram. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. And I'm teaching you how to connect with great people and manage relationships using the same software systems and tiny habits that I use every day. That's our 6-minute networking course. That course is free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. I'm teaching you how to dig the well before you get thirsty and create relationships before you need them. Of course, waiting until you do is too late. Many of the guests on the show subscribe and contribute to the course. Come join us. You'll be in smart company. This show is created in association with Podcast One. My team is Jen Harbinger, Jace Sanderson, Robert Fogarty, Millie Ocampo, Ian Baird, Josh Ballard, and Gabriel Mizrahi. Remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for this show is you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting. If you know somebody who would love to hear from Apollo Ono, could benefit from his advice or wisdom here, definitely share this episode with them. The greatest compliment you can give us is to share the show with those you care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time. Special thanks to Peloton for sponsoring this episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show.